You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tonight, California voters will get another chance to hear from the four leading candidates running for the late Senator Dianne Feinstein seat. They are Democratic Congress members Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, Barbara Lee, and Republican Steve Garvey. The debate will be televised across California, and it can be seen locally on Fox 40 here tonight at 7 p.m. And the debate may prove to be really critical, since the top two candidates, regardless of party, will move on to the November election. Last week, I spoke with Congressman Adam Schiff about his candidacy and what sets him apart from the rest. Congressman Schiff, thank you for making the time.
Great to be with you.
You've been serving the House since 2001. That's more than 20 years. How have your views on immigration evolved?
Well, I think we need a comprehensive immigration reform, and I've felt that way for a great many years now. Frankly, I'm skeptical the Republicans are ever going to help us do this. I think they view the border as the political gift that won't stop giving. And I think Donald Trump has made that pretty apparent just within the last couple of weeks. But, you know, in the interest of Democratic self-criticism and candor, when we controlled the House and Senate and the White House, we didn't get it done. And that's on my party. I want to make sure in the Senate that I fight to do away with the filibuster for many reasons, to restore reproductive freedom, to restore voting rights, but also to pass a comprehensive immigration reform that provides a pathway to citizenship for 11 million that are living in the shadows, that helps the dreamers become citizens and farm workers. I think we're going to have to do this ourselves, and I'm going to fight to do away with the filibuster so we can finally get that done.
You bring up a key issue. I mean, at the root of this is achieving bipartisan support across houses. I mean, and this issue transcends immigration. It has been harder, if not seemingly impossible, to get past gridlock. Why are you best positioned to work across the aisle to get bills signed into law?
I have the longest track record of doing exactly that. I was able to build an early earthquake warning system. I was able to build mass transit in LA. I'm known as the father of the Gold Line. I've passed open space legislation. I passed bills to protect press freedom and attack nuclear proliferation. I brought back millions to house people who are unhoused. These initiatives are bipartisan initiatives. Even in the midst of the worst fights I had on the Intelligence Committee with Devin Nunes, Republican Devin Nunes, over Trump and Russia and Ukraine and presidential abuse of power, we continue to get our annual intelligence bills passed on a very bipartisan basis. In Congress, you need to compartmentalize. You need to say, okay, we're going to fight over these other issues, but we're also going to find common ground. To build light rail, I needed to work with Republican David Dreyer. To fund critical NASA missions, I need to work with Republican John Culberson. And there are many examples of those partnerships, and I think I have the strongest record of actually getting things done for California.
When it comes to crime, according to the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, the state's violent crime rate has increased when compared to pre-COVID 2019. And this is also a national trend as well. But we're still well below like a third of the peak, which was in the early 1990s. But what is your role if elected as senator? Where do you see this? Do you see this as more of a state-local issue? Where would your role be as senator?
I think it is federal, state, and local. I think we all have to work together to make sure that people are safe, people have right to be safe in their homes, in their communities, in their businesses, and feel safe. This is an issue I've wrestled with since I was a prosecutor in Los Angeles with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I think what we're going to need to do to make our communities more safe again is, first of all, work on prevention, keep young people in school and out of trouble, but also invest in community-based policing where our police forces work hand-in-hand with the community and are well-trained not to use excessive force and to adopt intervention strategies that are conducive of the public safety. I think it's going to require more use of tools like DNA evidence. I was very proud to bring back millions for California to eliminate rape kit backlogs. I also helped get a regional DNA crime lab established so that we could solve property crimes like these smash and grab robberies and other serious crimes. So I think it's going to take a comprehensive approach, and the federal government has a real role to play.
You have also supported, you know, what would be considered tough on crime policies early on in your tenure. As you mentioned, you're also a former prosecutor. I mean, should you be judged according to your track record? I mean, some of the policies were increased funding for more cops in neighborhoods. You authored that piece of legislation, stiffer penalties for juveniles.
I also authored the most far-reaching criminal justice reform, I think, in the state's history, the Schiff Cardenas Crime Prevention Act of 2000, which has provided, I think, hundreds of millions of dollars to keep young people engaged in school and in productive activities and vocational training. The RAND Corporation has said that legislation that I co-authored and co-wrote has resulted in lower arrest rates, lower incarceration rates, and lower costs. So I'm proud to have authored that proactive and preventive legislation. You're right, in the 1990s, crime rates were very high. Some of the strategies we used didn't work. Others, like the Schiff Cardenas bill, has worked, does work. I've tried to model that in Congress with similar legislation and work with Tony Cardenas on it.
When it comes to the hindsight that you have as a prosecutor, also as a Congress member, has there been harm or unintended consequences to the laws of the past, to the laws of, say, like the 90s or early 2000s? How does that shape how your views have evolved over that time?
I think there have been unintended consequences in the 90s in terms of some of the tough on crime legislation that resulted in more incarceration but didn't result in safer communities. My experience has demonstrated to me over the years that what is most effective as a deterrent to keep people from committing crimes is not necessarily the length of sentence, but rather the certainty that they will be caught and the certainty they will face some kind of a consequence. And so I certainly favor moving to a deterrence along those lines, which is why I've put such a heavy emphasis on the use of DNA evidence, which is such a powerful tool, both to find those responsible for violent and nonviolent crimes, but also can be really powerful in exonerating those who are not guilty. So I think with tools like that, with good community-based policing, with a federal, state, and local task force devoted to interdicting fentanyl and dealing with the fentanyl crisis, we can dramatically reduce crime.
Do you think there should be stiffer penalties when it comes to fentanyl? I mean, given the rise in opioid-related deaths and overdoses?
I think, certainly going after the traffickers, the organized crime rings, and deterring them is an important part of the solution. And I've sought to get increased funding at the border to interdict fentanyl. We also, though, need strategies to educate the public about the dangers of fentanyl, as well as provide resources for schools and neighborhoods where, if there is a fentanyl overdose, people can be quickly treated and lives can be saved. So I think it's a combination of deterrence and interdiction, intervention and education, if we're going to get ahead of this terrible scourge.
A big issue, arguably the biggest, I think, to a lot of Californians is homelessness. California is home to the largest unhoused population in the country. Many counties, like here in Sacramento, hit record numbers. An unprecedented amount of funding has been dedicated to this. But if you ask a lot of people, I think, they don't really see or feel a significant difference in their neighborhoods. What is the federal government's role in this? What could you do as senator?
I think the most important role the federal government can play is in incentivizing the building of a lot more affordable housing. At its most basic, this is a supply problem. There simply isn't enough housing, and certainly not enough housing that people can afford. And unless we in California alone start to build hundreds of thousands of new units, we're never going to get ahead of this problem. No matter what we spend, there will be more people becoming homeless than we're finding shelter for. So we need to build a lot more. The low-income housing tax credit is something I've been a big champion of, because that changes the incentives. It aligns them so that developers will build housing that's affordable. We also need to reduce a lot of the roadblocks to building affordable housing. In some municipalities, it can take up to 4 years to build new housing. We're never going to solve this problem if it's going to take us 4 years. So I think the federal government also should incentivize local governments to get to yes quickly on their housing elements, on their plans for affordable housing. And we also need to provide relief for renters. And I support a renter's tax credit. If you're lucky enough to buy a house, you get help with your mortgage on your taxes, but you don't get help if you're a renter. And I think that's inequitable. And it also, because the rents have been going up so dramatically, is forcing people out of their homes.
Realistically, how do you incentivize local governments and in a state as diverse in demographics as California to streamline and speed up building housing?
Well, I think, you know, through the community development block grant program, through federal funding, we can incentivize those communities that have good, strong housing elements, that is, have incorporated into their urban plans the building of affordable housing, that are moving with alacrity to make that happen. We can establish the metrics to do that. I also think we're going to need to provide more federal support for the wraparound services so that when we do move people into shelter, they're helped in staying in shelter by getting mental health issues addressed, by getting substance abuse issues addressed. And a lot of local communities lack the resources to do that. Federal government, I think, needs to step up and provide a lot more of that support.
Are you satisfied with how the state is handling this issue? Do you understand why a lot of people are frustrated?
I totally understand why people are frustrated. I'm frustrated, too. And I'm particularly frustrated when we see, notwithstanding how much we're spending to find housing for people, that each year there seem to be more people unhoused than the year before. The one thing I will say where we've made very substantial progress is in finding housing for our homeless veterans. We've shown, frankly, what a comprehensive approach can do when you concentrate on the problem. And I think we've had we've addressed about 50% of the homeless problem among our veterans, which is still not enough, but it is progress. But I completely understand the public's frustration. In my experience, people are very compassionate. They don't want their neighbors to have to live on the street. They want to be able to use their parks and feel safely when they bring their kids to the park. They're willing to spend money to do that, but they want to know their money is well spent. And I also think one thing the federal government can do is establish these standards by which we can measure, okay, this is working, we should continue to invest in it, and this is not. This is a waste of money. And I think establishing those kind of measurements and deliverables is really important to restore public confidence in the approach.
Tied to this is the cost of living in California. I mean, state leaders will say that we are the fifth largest economy in the world, but California, a lot of Californians feel priced out in this state. It's already one of the most expensive places to live in the country. Among that, we have inflation, and I know that's national, but we have the highest gas prices, taxes, real estate. What can you do if elected a senator? What tangible policies could you achieve to address inflation and its impact on Californians?
Well, in terms of affordability, you know, the number one crisis, I think, is housing. So building a lot more housing will help bring down the cost of housing. But also, people can't afford childcare. And for many families, they're spending more on childcare than they are on their mortgage. And in order to solve that problem of unaffordable childcare, we're going to have to incentivize the construction of new childcare facilities. We're going to have to pay our childcare professionals higher salaries. There's a real shortage. A lot of people willing to do the work. There are lots of people that want to do the work, but don't want to do it for poverty wages. And so I've been working on legislation to create stronger incentives to provide affordable childcare, to increase compensation, to reduce student debt among those that go into providing childcare. I would like to see a system where if you're paying more than 5 to 10% of your income on childcare, you get the rest back in your tax rebate. So we need to address the high cost of childcare. We need to bring down gas prices. And I think, frankly, a big part of that is oil companies gouging us. I have a bill that would put a windfall profits tax on the oil companies and suspend the gas tax and pay for it with that windfall profits tax on oil companies. For food prices, we need to attack these mergers, these anti-competitive mergers, where one grocery chain, gobbles up another and they just raise prices. So there are, I think, a lot of things we can do to bring down costs, but it's going to differ in each sector of the economy, and it's going to require that we focus on increasing supply, the supply of housing, the supply of childcare, as well as attacking anti-competitive behavior.
We only have a few minutes left, and I want to get to an important distinction that you have with your colleagues in Congress that are also running for senator as well, and that comes to the Israel-Hamas war. Can you explain your stance on this war as it stands today?
I just starting at the starting point, which was October 7th. There was a ceasefire before October 7th. Hamas violated it with a brutal attack in which they murdered Israelis, they raped Israelis, kidnapped Americans. It was indiscriminate, brutal, deadly, designed to be. Israel has a right to defend itself, not only from that attack, but from future attacks, which Hamas is committed to undertaking. No nation could, I think, withstand that kind of attack without responding. So I think the United States should support Israel in defending itself. At the same time, we should continue to work with Israel to reduce the number of civilian casualties, to make sure that we get aid to people in Gaza and that we get hostages out of Gaza. I'm very hopeful that that Secretary Blinken and others will be successful in negotiating another pause in the fighting to get hostages out and get aid in. But I have not supported a permanent ceasefire that would permanently entrench Hamas governing Gaza. That would permanently mean our hostages, American hostages, are still held by a terrorist group. But I do support these humanitarian pauses to get aid in and hostages out.
You know, as it stands today, it's 4 months since October 7th, and the death toll in Gaza is more than 27,000 people. You know, as I know you're well aware, a majority are women and children. I believe 85% are displaced from their homes in Gaza. Starvation is increasing. How do you view this, and what is your role in this as a lawmaker in Congress?
It is a terrible, terrible tragedy that so many people have lost their lives, that these hostages are still in Hamas custody, that so many people are being used as human shields by Hamas. My heart breaks for all those families that have been displaced who, have nothing to do with Hamas. I think, it's a terrible, terrible loss of life. And I think that the way to move forward in this region is to ensure that Hamas is not governing Gaza, that we get the hostages released, that we put the region back on the path to a two-state solution in which both Gaza and the West Bank are under Palestinian control, under a reformed Palestinian Authority. I think a two-state solution is the only real long-term answer to this conflict. And so I think every effort has to be made to get us back to a path to making that happen. And I have some hope, although hope is a scarce commodity in this part of the world, but I have some hope that maybe a deal can be struck in which Saudi Arabia recognizes Israel, normalizes relationship with Israel. Israel recognizes a Palestinian state comprised of Gaza and the West Bank and governed by Palestinians and the reformed authority. And that we can find a lasting peace in the region. That's what I hope. That's what I aim for. That's what I bent all my efforts towards during my time in Congress.
We're less than a month to the primary, and I know we're going to be wrapping up. What do you say to voters who have apathy and they're just kind of exhausted and they're done with politics? They're done with career politicians. They believe that they're out of touch, and they're finding it difficult to get motivated to vote. What do you say to these voters in California?
Well, I would say that this is one of the most important elections they're ever going to vote in, because our very democracy is on the ballot. If Donald Trump is successful and returns to the Oval Office, we may not become a full dictatorship, but we will not be the same democracy that we have been. And we will certainly make no progress on the things that they care the most about. I've been fighting to attack climate change and championing a Green New Deal and moving us to a green economy. That will never happen under a Donald Trump presidency. We will move farther away from that goal. I want to do away with the filibuster so we can attack the scourge of gun violence. Donald Trump isn't going to do anything about that. If anything, he'll make the problem worse. And you can go right down the list of things that young people care the most about. I'm fighting to do away with student debt. I want to make sure we restructure our higher ed so that students don't have to become so indebted in the future, that we forgive debt that students have now. That's something Joe Biden is also working on. All of these things are going to be determined on this ballot. And I understand the skepticism, I understand the cynicism, but I also understand the imperative of this election. And I'm certainly doing all my part, all I can in the Senate campaign to engage young people. In visiting college campuses, we've been very active on social media. We've got a young contingent that's really been doing a great job both on our campaign staff, but also among our volunteers. Because I think young people are really going to decide this election. Whether they turn out will decide who the president of the United States is. And this just couldn't be a more important time.
But given your past history with President Trump, if he becomes reelected, do you see a way where the two of you could have a productive relationship if you're elected senator?
Well, if he continues with his plans to be a dictator on day one, I don't know how anything productive is going to get done. We do need someone in the Senate, should that worst of scenarios happen, that has a track record of leading in big fights like that. And I think alone among the candidates, I was in the middle of that fight while others were on the sidelines. And we need someone who's going to be in the middle of the fight to preserve our democracy if the worst happens at the top of the ticket. Now, even when he was president, in the few meetings I had with him, I raised infrastructure. I raised prescription drug prices, things I thought both parties could work on. He was touting infrastructure week for 4 years without doing anything on infrastructure. But I'm always looking for ways we can move the country forward, and I'll continue to do so. But I fear for the country's future should he ever go near the instruments of power again.
Congressman Schiff, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
That is Congressmember Adam Schiff, who is running for Senate. Our conversation was recorded last week. We're also going to air our conversation with Representative Katie Porter on Wednesday. Our conversation with Representative Barbara Lee is scheduled for later this month. And we're still trying to get Mr. Garvey to join us as well. We'll keep you posted. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.